Hello, good evening, and welcome. This is Samuel Trapp. You are on Dem Radio, and this is International Flavor. Sorry for the tiny delay there. I got cut off. Don't know whether I did it myself or if something else is to blame, but it's probably me. Brain cramp of some sort, and had too much on my mind today. How about that? We have plenty to talk about. I listened to about half of JR's show. Sorry, JR, I wasn't there to support you as I normally am, to listen to you all the way through. There's been quite a few things going on in the world, and I was paying particular attention today to, if you haven't seen it, I saw it was pulled up, and maybe some people have, but I found it very interesting, the way in which they elected to do this in Russia, the speech of Sergei Lavrov. It was Sergei Lavrov, Maria Zakharova, and they were meeting with a U.S. blogger, a young kid, and he's, he always seems to get these cool gigs over there. He's interviewed Lavrov a couple of times, and he does a good job, speaks in English. Lavrov speaks in English. And both times that Lavrov has done these interviews with this blogger have been pretty decent. And this one was went on for about an hour and a half. And there's so much to see in that video. If you don't get a chance, or if you haven't had a chance, you should take a chance to go back and listen to this interview, all of it. The people who are there, I think I recognize Judge Napolitano there interviewing as well. And it is... oh, damn it, where is the header? Let's see what we can find. Because it was put on by the Ministry of Foreign Affairs of Russia that allowed this interview to go on. And it was an American blogger, Judge Napolitano, and a guy named Johnson, Larry Johnson. And it was a pretty good interview. And I think that we should listen to one whole question on what they had to say, but I'm having I tell you what, there's so much to talk about related to it. So basically, when you get started, that yesterday I went on and on about what I feel to be, I don't want to call it a failure, but not a whole lot of success, let's call it, on the front of coming up with some kind of a strategy to get Ukraine to agree to a ceasefire. I suppose I've had some time to think about it now. If you have thoughts on it and you want to join me before the old Sergei Lavrov, I put him out there in English, because I think it's important to get these things from the horse's mouth. It's nice to hear it. There's been some statements by our fearless leader, Donald Trump, as well. He said yesterday that he thinks it's a 75%. They're 75% of the way to peace. I don't know where he comes up with these numbers, but I suppose that that I could agree to 75%. I don't know that I'm necessarily against it, but I don't know where he comes up with these numbers. To say he's 75% of the way to peace, it would be very nice if he was. All the news, and there's been plenty of it, on the other side of the world is that basically... in the last day, the Russians have driven the Ukrainians almost completely from Kursk, and so the foolhardiness of taking Kursk in the first place has now done nothing but kill a bunch of people on both sides, of course, cause all kinds of loss of equipment, loss of lives, loss of money, entire cities. And it didn't give the strategic positions that they had so hoped in Ukraine that they would have something to exchange. And I got to thinking last night after my show about some of the things I believe about the weakness of this ceasefire discussion. And I think it's weak because they're going to offer something that Russia won't accept. But after listening to Lavrov today, I'm thinking that maybe I'll give a 10 to 15% chance that they will accept something along the lines of a ceasefire to give the sides an opportunity to talk together. By the way, if you want to call into the show, you're certainly welcome to 573-746-8020, and we can discuss whatever you would like. However, I would like to keep it on this topic. There was an interesting take on this from one of the guys I listen to. I like to listen to news from the front at least once a day, you know, and there's a guy who does, and I've played him on here before, he does, he's called it the Military Summary Channel, the guy with the very strong Russian accent, and he does every 12 hours, twice a day, he does an update. And he does an update to the things on the front. He's a map coordinator, one of the map guys. And there's quite a few of them online that get on and they show the territories that are taken and the offensives that are happening and where the war is the toughest and things of that nature. So it's it's interesting. I think I might play him his first little part for you to show you where is he. Let's see if I go back and find him. I don't want Mr. Lavrov speaking just yet, but I do want to tell you some of Lavrov when I get to him, but not quite yet. We're going to go to the military summary gentleman and talk to his and listen to at least the first part of his stream from earlier today. And so let us make sure that I have this correct. And we'll play him to give you a little bit of...
Hello, my dear friends. You're on the Military Summary Channel. And today we will discuss the situation in Ukraine on the 12th of March of 2025. Today we have a lot of very interesting updates. So let's start. And as for the end of the 12th of March, there are two of the most interesting and the most important topics related to Ukraine. The first one is the battle for Sudzha and possible consequences of this situation. And the second, a very important question, is the 30 days ceasefire that was proposed by the United States of America. The consequences, the real results, and what kind of benefits each side is going to receive if they accept this ceasefire. First, let's talk about Sudzha, because the Russians continue their offensive operation, and as for the end of the 12th of March of 2025, the Russians managed to secure probably up to 70% of the entire Sudzha agglomeration. As for the city of Sudzha, the city was completely secured by the Russians by the morning of the 12th of March, and during the previous 12 hours the Russians were advancing further in the western and the northwestern directions towards the settlement of Goncharovka and the settlement by the name of Zaleshenka. As for the end of this day, the Russians managed to take under control up to 40% of Zaleshenka. This is the settlement that is located in the northwestern part of the Sudzha agglomeration. Now let's take a look at the map and let's compare the changes. For example, this is the situation by the end of the
I don't want to go through all of that. I'm going to listen to him in the little bit on the side and hopefully hear. I want to hear the part what I should have forwarded to the part where they talk about the 30 days, but they've basically kicked everybody out of Suja, and the Ukrainians are really on their heels in that region. And it's something is going on with YouTube, by the way, because YouTube, which has been blocking any sort of positive news on anything having to do with Russia and Russian advances, is now there are quite a few that I wonder if they're being pressured or setting themselves up, if they're being pressured to give a more favorable view of what is going on, or a less tainted or twisted view to what is happening during this war, this conflict. I think it's apparent that something is being done differently, and that is a surprise to me. Maybe they are setting themselves up for something different, for change. And it certainly in the discussions with Lavrov, I got to thinking about this, because this interview was done 13 hours ago, which means it would have been, you know, early this morning, Russian time, would have been done. And it was on the 12th, and it was an hour and a half long, a little bit longer than an hour and a half. And Lavrov is pretty has a pretty good command of the English language as well. And he said some very cool things. But what I think I'll do, because I think you should go back and listen to this if you want to hear a reasonable person tell a reasonable tale of what he thinks is going on with the U.S., just the first question, and the first question is going to take us like 10 to 10 minutes, maybe a little longer, because it's a long question. We shall listen to first the question and then his response, if you do not mind. Let us get there, and we will.
Mr. Minister, it's a pleasure to speak to you, sir. The first question I have is, as I speak to people here in Moscow, there's a perception that the U.S. has changed. They're describing the U.S. completely differently under President Trump. Do you think the U.S. as a culture, not only the perception, but do you think has it fundamentally changed, and their perception of Russia and President Putin?
Now, listen to this answer, because this is good, and he talks for several minutes here, but he wants to know what the difference is between America under Trump and America previously. And Lavrov has been around a long time. So, you know, he's been the foreign minister for 25 years. He's the longest serving foreign minister on the planet. And so he is, this guy, like him or dislike him, he's definitely good, and he is definitely a diplomat, and that has been missing for a long time on our side of the equation. Anyway, so here you go. Listen up.
I think what is going on in the United States is a return to normalcy. The United States has always been the country of two big parties who competed between themselves, who changed ownership of the White House. But the division during my years in the United States, which is starting from 1981, I've been there several times, serving for a long period, compared to that time, the division now is absolutely striking. On that occasion, the main dividing line between the Democrats and the Republicans was more taxes, less taxes, abortions, things which would be part of a normal Christian life, and within this Christianity values, the entire politics were built. Arguing with each other, but within the values which everybody accepted. With the introduction of neoliberal ideas, neocon ideas, but mostly neoliberal ideas, the divide became deeper, wider, culmination was the first election of President Trump, which he himself admitted was a surprise to him, and he wasn't really getting ready. Now he is ready, and it is clear how many, 49 days yet, and such a rich agenda is already thrown into the public domain. So this split motivated, first of all, by the departure from Christian values, by the leadership of the Democratic Party, in my view, by promoting without any limits the LGBTQ, whatever comes next, one WC for any gender. I once found myself in Sweden where the OSCE was conducting a ministerial meeting, and it was in a stadium specially arranged for the ministerial meeting, and I wanted to get out and to go out and saw WC sign, and I asked the guy who was accompanying me whether this was gents or ladies. He said, everybody. I don't want any of my friends to experience this themselves. So this, and this is just, of course, a tiny manifestation of those divisions, but the America as we Rust Belt America is, of course, not very much keen to embrace those values, and the persistence with which, fanatic persistence with which those values were brought, promoted to the population, certainly made quite a number of people to decide for themselves that this is not what they want, and they supported Donald Trump. So it's back to normalcy as we understand normalcy. We are Orthodox Christians. The values are basically the same, though Catholicism now is becoming more and more deviating to the new trends, which we cannot understand and which we would not accept. But the fact that a normal administration without any unchristian ideas came to power, and the reaction was such an explosion in the media, in the politics all over the world, is very interesting and is very telling. When we met, I hope I don't reveal any secret, when we met in Riyadh with Marco Rubio and Mike Waltz and Steve Witkoff, they suggested the meeting, and they said, look, we want normal relations. Normal relations in the sense that the foundation of the American foreign policy under the Trump administration is national interest of the United States. this is absolute and without any discussion. But at the same time, we understand that other countries also have their national interests. Right. And those countries who have their national interests and don't play into the hands of somebody else's interest,
right,
we are ready to have serious discussion. It is very well understood, they told us, that countries like the United States and Russia would never have their national interest the same. They would not coincide maybe even 50 or less percent. But when they do coincide, this situation, if we are responsible politicians, must be used to develop this simultaneous and similar interest into something practical which would be mutually beneficial, be it economic projects, infrastructural projects, something else. And then another message went, but when the interest do not coincide and contradict each other, again, this is then the responsible countries must do everything not to allow this contradiction to degenerate into confrontation, especially military confrontation, which would be disastrous for many other countries.
Right.
We told them, we fully share this logic. It's absolutely the way President Putin wants and does conduct our foreign policy. He always, since he became president, underlines in his contacts that we are not imposing anything on anyone, and that we are looking for a balance of interest. Same logic, absolutely. And you know, some people would say, "Oh, Russia is now changing and is turning away from the East, from China, from India, from Africa." It's an illusion. And euphoria is not what should be guiding us in foreign policy. By the way, China, for decades, has relations with the United States based exactly on the formula which I just described. Mm-hmm. They sometimes call each other names, which we don't mind. I mean, we also, in modern diplomacy, are using to get to new vocabulary, but they never interrupted a dialogue. They would say, "Hands off Taiwan, hands off South China Sea, but let's meet and talk." It's the same approach, the same logic, which is now accepted by Trump and by the Trump administration in its relationship with the Russian Federation, and I think it's only right. There are no two persons who would be 100% alike, and same with countries. And countries who can seriously influence the fate of the world, militarily, the nuclear powers in particular, of course, they have special responsibility not to shout at each other, but to sit down and talk and say, more or less like it was handled by cowboys in many of the Hollywood movies. He said that, "You know, and I know that you know that I know, and what do you, are you going to tell me?" Something.
Yes, please, Andrew.
Well, what do you think of that answer? I let it go on toward the end because I liked at the end. I think he got the quote just about wrong, and I haven't been able to find it, but he was close on it. He said, like cowboys resolve issues or resolved them in Hollywood movies in the Old West. One in particular said, "I know what I know. I know what you know." And I don't remember the whole thing. Maybe somebody remembers that quote, but I remember seeing it. And but his response there was, It went on for literally, we're 10 minutes in, and there was a short question by this blogger, and the blogger's name is Mario Nawfal, N-A-W-F-A-L. And Andrew Napolitano was there, and Larry C. Johnson. And this was done March 12th in Moscow. And the reason I put this out is Lavrov, you can think the way you want, but he outlined for us the United States approach and how it was given to him. And I'm telling you, and he said, we don't want to let euphoria dictate our responses to anything, because we are glad that we've returned to, you heard what he called it in his first sentence. Trump came into office and suddenly we have normalcy. And who'd have ever thought Russia would be lecturing us, America, on Christian values, saying that even the Catholic Church is far, far away from where it used to be. Now, I don't know the details of that. I truly don't pay attention. But he says, and the Russian Orthodox, you know, their Orthodoxes are pretty strict in what they believe. And, you know, they believe in the same things that we believe in, you know. I don't know, country, God, family, you know, that kind of thing. And that we believe in these things. He said, he gave these stories, said that from the time he was, that the parties have changed dramatically from when he started coming to the U.S. back in 1981, or early 80s, I think he said, and how it is today. Used to be the differences between the Republicans and Democrats were more taxes, less taxes, abortion, that kind of thing. And now they have all this craziness, you know, LGBTQ+++, blah, 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 which they're not for in Russia, and they'll never support. Their people won't support it. It's, you know, their traditions, their values. They're not going to let these things take over. But even Putin has said in speeches that I've heard, what you do in the privacy of your own home, fine. You're just not going to spread it all over the streets. I don't know. Maybe that's too strict. I don't know. But I don't think it should be broadcast to the planet like it is in America, that the preferred way to be living your life is as a purple-pink-haired he-she of some sort, which I don't care if you want to do that. Even publicly, it doesn't bother me all that much, but I still think it's something that ought to be more private, you know, a little more private. You maybe remember last week's discussion about, I think it was on JR's show, can't remember. Somebody else's could have been, it might have been totally different program I was listening to, where they were talking about the transgender senator and the efforts to exclude that person from the women's bathroom in the Capitol buildings. And here's what I think. I think, and this might be a bit extreme, but I wouldn't be against having a separate bathroom for transgenders. You know, why in the world women should be subject to a biological man being in their bathroom? I don't think so. Or if the woman doesn't want to, if the biological man who wants to be a woman or considers himself a woman doesn't want to be with men in the bathroom, I can understand that as well. Perhaps there ought to be like a handicapped bathroom. A lot of places have these now, like third sorts of bathrooms. You go into many places and there's a family sort of bathroom when you go to a rest area, or you go because men are changing babies' diapers and blah, blah, blah. I don't mind that. It's just, why are we subjecting a female, which could be a small girl, you know, the age of, you know, when are you allowed to go to the bathroom in a rest area by yourself? And when are you going to be subject to somebody who's biologically a man in there going to the bathroom same time as you are when you're six and your parents can't go or somebody's not there. I don't know. I'm thinking it's a... I'm thinking I could be convinced that a third bathroom should be available or something like that. But Lavrov was telling the story about when he was in Sweden, and this happened to me a couple of times. I'll tell you a couple stories about this because you all know me and my stories. But this, when he was in Sweden, he was at a meeting of the OIC, and he said that he went out, goes to use a bathroom, and there's just one bathroom. And, you know, hey, here's how he was uncomfortable with that, didn't like it. Well, first time I ran into a bathroom like that was, I was in the Army. I was serving in Fort Hood, Texas, is where I was stationed. So it had to be between the years of 87 and 89. Late 89. I was only there for not quite 3 years. And it was in between my initial stint at the Defense Language Institute in Monterey, California, and then my follow-on training in Monterey in 1990 for the treaty duty, learning Russian treaty-specific. And we used to go... me and a couple of friends. Well, I got some stories I can tell about that ridiculousness. Going to Austin used to be the thing to do. To go out, go to Austin on a big college town, huge college town, pretty liberal even back then. Although Texas was definitely a conservative state, and I remember going to a bar. And in downtown, I think it was called 6th Street down there in Austin, but God, if I remember, now it was a long time ago. And going and, you know, we used to call it chasing white women. We'd go down there and have a lot of fun chasing the little college girls. And I went into to use the bathroom, and there's a urinal. Now, there's several urinals. You got to stack urinals against the wall. This was some dance club. It's late at night, you know, 11 o'clock, midnight, God knows. And so I'm there using the restroom, go in the bathroom, and all of a sudden I look to my right, and there's a girl, probably around my age. Around that time I would have been in my early 20s. And, she was straddling the urinal. She was straddling the urinal and going to the bathroom. And I was like, what in the hell are you doing? And she goes, what? And, you know, she's like, I'm the bad person, you know? It's like, I shouldn't be looking at her, I guess. I don't know. I was like, but there's not a girl's bathroom? And she said, oh, I don't know, something to the effect of that I was prudish or that I was something like this. I mean, I was like, whatever, you know, finished up my business and left. And God knows if at that time, but then when I went outside, it was, there was a dual symbols on both the doors. So men and women could use either one. And I just never paid attention, didn't know it. And then I ran into that in Europe when I was stationed over there. Quite a few times in the late 80s, early 90s, you know, in my times in Europe. Germany is pretty, free reign back then. And had these strange bathroom policies that everyone would go and we would have to... Well, but Germany also allowed men to just go to the bathroom on the side of the road, you know, just face away, you know, and turn to the side and go to the bathroom. They're not as, I guess, prudish would be a good word, as we are. But you aren't doing that in Russia. Okay? And he said, and Lavrov said, most of America, you know, the Rust Belt states, he's talking about the Midwest is what he's talking about. Because the Rust Belt, you know, that really defines, I think he got his thought process wrong, you know, that he was really talking about the Midwest and not the coastal areas of the United States, because the Rust Belt is really just the Northeast Midwest. You know, your Michigan, Wisconsin, Ohio, you know, Pennsylvania, those areas where steel and car manufacturing, stuff like that, was prevalent. And that, you know, in Europe, and in New York and on the coasts, this liberal thought process has taken a strong effect. And so him telling that story is pretty revealing. And he said that when he met, that he and Rubio and his team, and when they talked about these, they were, they think along the same pages. And maybe normalcy really has returned. I like to hear this. I don't like to hear the constant neocon, neoliberal statements that, you know, we have to take over the world. We have to take over the world. We have to push, you know, our thoughts upon everybody else on the planet. And we have to push this LGBTQ all over, you know, through whatever, through USAID for Internet, or Agency for International Development, US, you know, whatever, pick them. And we don't have to do that. Russia's not doing that. They aren't telling other countries. BRICS certainly isn't telling other countries how they have to think. And much of what he said in this speech is exactly the same thing that they put out in their joint statement at BRICS, saying this is how countries need to deal with each other, and we're providing you an alternative to come to BRICS to work through this with us, where we won't interfere in your nationalism of your own particular country. Don't bother ours, and you can't be a member unless you commit that you're not in dispute with other people as far as trying to tell one or the other of them what to do. Now, allegedly, there's that Trump has said that there's a meeting, that there will be meetings fairly soon with Putin. Phone call, something. I saw in a couple of places where they said the phone call is scheduled for this Friday. And in some of the articles of what they're saying, that these talks are coming up. And so I think that these discussions where you get to hear a normal speaker, like I said, you know, leading into this, is saying the way that these Sergei Lavrov, with Maria Zakharova sitting right next to him the entire time, the entire hour and a half that they were sitting there. These are the people who are the face of Russia outside of the country. Zakharova, well, and Nebenzia, the UN spokesperson for Russia, and you know, those three people are probably the most important spokespersons for Russia, and they all say the same thing. Zakharova goes off on this all the time. You can call it propaganda if you like, but it's propaganda that makes sense. You know, when we listen to our propaganda, we're sitting there going, oh yeah, LGBTQ, that's purely propaganda, because we know not everybody supports it. How in the world does anybody not support saying that our country, we do what we want, your country, you do what you want, and when our interests coincide, we will try to capitalize on that. And when they are not, we will try to prevent it from rising to the level of an armed conflict between our militaries. Are you kidding me? That instead, you know, what neocons and neolibs have been doing for at least the last 30 years, if probably not longer, is forcing their views on the rest of the world. And, you know, it's a welcome change to think of people thinking like this. Is, by God, this is what Putin said in 07. He said that a one-size-fits-all unipolar world isn't going to work. I don't know how many times that needs to be broadcasted by how many people before neo-libs and neo-cons get it through their heads. But there you have it. There's you know, show going on. My guy that I listened to, Alex Christoforou, I listened to him for a while today. He had some good news that he was putting out as well. I like his comments and how he thinks. And he said he was commenting on what the Green Goblin is getting out of this. And the Green Goblin did his own little blurb on his Instagram or whatever it was that he does from his office in the middle of the night, and said that, well, we're prepared, just like I said yesterday, we're prepared to cease fire. Now let's just hope that the United States can convince Russia to go to a ceasefire. And I got to thinking about this after my long commentary on this exact topic yesterday, when I said that they were putting the onus on Russia to be the bad guy now, that Ukraine's all for peace and Russia is not, because Russia doesn't want just 30 days of peace. And I got to thinking about this a little bit, maybe a little bit more, and seeing some other commentary on it. I think several people have had similar responses like I had yesterday, that this is kind of a, you know, a meatless sandwich, you know, a vegan victory, if you want to call it that, which I'm not against, but you got to be ready for that. And I was not. If I would have thought there's going to be something a little more positive to force, but maybe Russia will play along briefly with this. I know that the Russian people and are tired. You know, so are the Ukrainians, and that nobody. I can't imagine there are people who want this war. Well, except for Zelensky, I truly believe that guy wants to. And these loonies in Europe, the leaders that don't represent their own people, their own interest, I believe that they really do want this war to continue. I really think that they do plan to continue saying that this was all driven solely by one person, not by reasonable, thoughtful people like Sergei Lavrov, but by a world power hungry, world dominance person like Vladimir Putin, who, if we don't take care of him now, he'll be in your neighborhood next. I don't believe that. I don't think anybody with any sense really believes that. That's just another narrative that they're trying to pump into you so that you avoid the truth. You know, that the truth is there's no reason for this war to have been going on, and if we hadn't have forced it, it wouldn't be going on. Now, Trump, of course, thinks it's all because he was absent, that this war all occurred, is because he was absent and Biden's an idiot. Although there's definitely a ring of truth to that, I wish he could just drop it, and I'm not sure he can. He always has to focus on, well, it wouldn't happen if I was around. Okay. But it did happen, and you weren't around. So drop it. Let's see what we can do to get this done. So one of the articles that I wanted to share with you today that came out just recently, we may listen to another question of Lavrov here a little bit later, just because he is pretty reasonable. But I do encourage you, if you got some YouTube or if you got wherever, the Foreign Ministry or the Ministry of Foreign Affairs of Russia has a YouTube channel. And this one happens to be in English, and Zakharova is there, Lavrov is there, and then these three people interviewing Lavrov in an hour and a half. It's worth your time to listen to, really is. because you get it straight from the horse's mouth. And how and now that we have a real president and who will get out and speak his mind. Now, if Joe Biden would have spoken his mind, you couldn't really complain. You know, at least he's telling you what he thought he was elected to do, but he never did. He never spoke in the first place, never answered a question in the second place, and nothing was there. You can say what you dislike about Trump, but the things that I like the most about him are his accessibility, his willing to answer questions, willing to get it straight from the horse's mouth, and the same thing is what you receive all the time. You can hate Putin all you like. You can hate Lavrov and Zakharova and Peskov and whoever else you want to as much as you like, but they answer questions and they speak on the topics just like Donald Trump does. And so it's kind of hard to condemn them because there's no way, if you're getting it straight from the horse's mouth, that it can all be 100% lies. I mean, come on. How good do you have to be to be lying about everything and keep track of all your lies? Everybody knows that you can't keep track of the lies, so therefore you as much as possible tell the truth. Same thing I like about the guy from what's his name? Lukashenko from Belarus. Same thing. You can dislike him all you want, but boy, he will give you time. And he lets himself be interviewed by bloggers too. Pretty interesting. Anyway, next article we're going to talk about is Trump teasing talks with Putin. He says that he believes a ceasefire between Russia and Ukraine can be achieved. So on Tuesday, he said he would likely hold phone talks with his Russian counterpart, Vladimir Putin, this week, expressing hope that Moscow would agree to the proposed 30-day ceasefire with Ukraine. Trump made these remarks to reporters shortly after the delegation in Jeddah, Saudi Arabia, met, where Kyiv agreed to Washington's proposal for a ceasefire. The U.S. president said striking an agreement would greatly aid in reaching a final deal to end the conflict. So, hopefully, this is a quote of Trump, hopefully Putin will also agree, and I really think that would be 75% of the way to get the war done, he means. The rest is getting it documented, you know, negotiating land positions, etc., Trump said. Should Russia not agree to the ceasefire, we just keep going on, the U.S. president said, warning that lots of people would be killed. Russian and U.S. officials are expected to hold meetings today and tomorrow to negotiate, he said. Shortly after Trump delivered these remarks, Russian Foreign Ministry spokeswoman Maria Zakharova said that contacts between Moscow and Washington in the coming days could not be ruled out. According to a reporter in the Kremlin pool, Dmitry Smirnov, a phone conversation between the U.S. and Russian presidents will be held on Friday. This is where I got that from. Thus far, Moscow has not provided any official reaction to the statements made following the conclusion of the U.S.-Ukraine talks in Jeddah. Previously, top Russian officials stated that a temporary truce is not a solution to the Ukraine conflict, and that root problems must be addressed instead. A pause in the hostilities will only be used by Kyiv and its backers to rearm, get ready for a new round of fighting, Moscow suggested. There you have it. There's a, I think this is a later article. This one came out, that one was yesterday as well. Heavy bummage. We don't want that. We want to get to where we are. Let's see. Oh, there's all, who else are we going to talk about today? And some of the things that the opposition is leading in Greenland elections. We wonder, this is interesting to me because we want to know their stance and how it will be when Trump goes up there and, you know, moves in the, you know, whatever fleet into one of their ports and puts an army base up on the northern shore of the Arctic. The historic vote could lead the Arctic island to seek independence from Denmark or closer ties with the U.S. Two opposition parties in Greenland, one favoring economic development and the other advocating immediate independence, are leading the country's parliamentary elections, according to preliminary results released on Wednesday. The vote has drawn international attention, partly due to Donald Trump's desire to purchase the island. I can't believe it. An autonomous territory of Denmark. Greenland has long been of strategic importance due to its Arctic location and untapped mineral resources. Trump initially proposed buying it during his first term at the White House in 2019, but the move was rejected by both Denmark and Greenland. Since returning to office, he has reignited discussions about U.S. influence, describing the island as crucial to American security and economic interest. According to early results, the centrists' Democratic Party, which supports economic expansion and a gradual approach to independence, is leading with 29% of the vote, a sharp rise from 9.1% in 2021. The pro-independence Nalarak Party, which has signaled openness to closer ties with the U.S., has secured 24%, nearly doubling its previous support. The ruling Inuit Atikatigluit Party, which also supports independence but at a slower pace, stands at 21%, while its left-wing coalition partner, Siamut, has dropped to 14.7%, a significant decline from the last election when the two parties controlled nearly two-thirds of the legislature. The former Danish colony was granted self-rule in 79, but Copenhagen retains control of foreign affairs, defense, and monetary policy, stretching 2.2 million square kilometers. With a population of about 60,000, the territory also hosts a key military U.S. military base at Thule. The island has the option to declare full independence through a referendum, but has yet to hold one, as concerns persist over economic stability. Denmark currently provides an annual subsidy that accounts for about a quarter of Greenland's economy. Speaking at a recent joint session of Congress, Trump reaffirmed his support for Greenland's right to determine its future, suggesting the territory could break away from Denmark and join the U.S. The president said Washington needs the island and will secure it. This made me, I was disgusted, one way or the other, despite the rejection of his previous purchase offer. Well, we're going to take it one way or the other, so you might as well just let me buy it. I tell you what, that is just lunacy, in my opinion. I just, you don't just go out and say, well, you know, I kind of like Bermuda. Why? Well, Bermuda could be a nice strategic place. Maybe we could finally research what's going on in the old Bermuda Triangle. And see if we can't, maybe that's a strategic importance. Don't we just go one, that they have a small population. Shouldn't we just go over there and take them all over? That's how the world works, right? Well, but not when you're the U.S. We're supposed to be the good guys that don't do that kind of thing. We defend the little guy, the one that wants to take care of himself. Now, if a pretty large referendum, and if Greenland and Denmark agreed with this kind of thing, okay, maybe. And maybe, like a lot of people like to say about Trump, I don't necessarily agree, but a lot of people like to say this about Trump, he's always making a deal, right? Interesting stuff. So, yesterday, day before, I was telling you about the attack on the Kursk region and the pipeline coming in through the gas. Well, Here was an interesting article that came out, said, Putin visits Russia's Kursk region, and there's a video of it, I'm watching it, it's playing. The Russian president listened to a report on military operations in the area and went to Kursk. He's in fatigues he's wearing, and he's coming into a military post as you watch it. Russian military must defeat the Ukrainian forces that invaded the Kursk region as soon as possible, President Putin said on Wednesday. He visited a command post in the region as Moscow's forces continue a major counteroffensive against Kiev's remaining troops in the area. The president, and by the way, they're pretty much routed out of there right now. They're on their way out the door. President held a meeting with Russian military commanders during his visit and listened to a report by the chief of general staff, General Valery Gerasimov. Putin thanked the general staff and the units fighting in the region. Our goal is to inflict defeat upon the enemy entrenched on the territory of Kursk on short notice, the president said, adding that Moscow would consider creating a security zone along the border with Ukraine as well. The Ukrainian units that invaded the region should be treated as terrorists, he said, including any Ukrainian fighters taken prisoner in the area. I don't know if you paid attention to this, but 2 weeks ago, maybe less, 10 days, something like that. I know I read it pretty recently. There's a British fighter fighting on the side of Ukraine that invaded into Kursk with the Ukrainians, and he was just sentenced to 19 years in jail. I'm going to see if I can find his name and tell you what it is, perhaps, because he was sentenced to 19 years. And now Russia's been pretty straight up about this since the very beginning of the war. They have said all of these mercenaries, all of these words, naomniki, all these naomniki that are coming over, some of them still in the militaries of other countries. Now, I don't have any proof of that, but that's what they say, that they're still going over and fighting, receiving their pay from other countries, but fighting for Ukraine. So basically, call them U.S. soldiers stationed. When it was first going on, they were saying that there were several U.S. generals, colonels, lots of pilots, American, doing all the training of them over there, and a lot of them got caught in the crossfires. But Russia said those that intrude into Russia and are captured will be treated as criminals. They've crossed the borders illegally. You know, they have engaged in acts of terrorism on our land because we don't recognize them as foreign combatants. Now, there's been a lot of outcry on this in the Hague and Geneva Convention stuff, you know, saying that they're military, and somebody saying they should return them to their, when they do prisoner swaps, sentenced in Russia. Here he is. Russia jails a UK man for 19 years for fighting for Ukraine. And his name is James Scott Rhys Anderson, convicted of mercenary activities and terrorist acts. And he's 22 years old. James Scott Anderson, 22, convicted of mercenary activities and terrorist act after 3-day closed military trial in Kursk, the court press service for the region said on Wednesday. This is actually a couple of weeks old, 6 March. So actually, no, not all that long ago. Anderson, who was reported captured in November while participating in the Kursk offensive, pleaded guilty to the charges against him. Under the terms of his sentence, Anderson will spend 5 years in prison before being transferred to a penal colony to serve out the remainder of his term. Footage release by the court showed Anderson nodding silently after the ruling was translated for him. The United Kingdom's Foreign and Commonwealth Office condemned Anderson's sentence on what it described as false charges. Under international law, prisoners of war cannot be prosecuted for participating in hostilities. We demand that Russia respect these obligations, including those under the Geneva Convention, and stop using prisoners of war for political and propaganda purposes. In 2022, a court in Russian-occupied Donetsk sentenced two British citizens and a Moroccan to death for acting as foreign mercenaries and partaking in terrorist activities. The three men were later released as part of a prisoner exchange brokered by Saudi Arabia. Speaking shortly after Russia's full-scale, here they're going to call it the full-scale invasion, February 22, then Ukraine Foreign Minister Dmytro Kuleba said more than 20,000 people from 52 countries had volunteered to fight for Kyiv. That came from Al Jazeera newspaper, just so you know. Interesting stuff. Anyway, according to Gerasimov, the Russian military, I'm continuing with the article about Putin visiting Kursk, Russian military has liberated 259 kilometers of territory, including 24 towns and villages, in the past 5 days. Kyiv's forces in the area are encircled and isolated. And from all the maps that I have been seeing on both the Russian side and the Ukrainian side, it's absolutely true. A video published by Kremlin shows Putin wearing military fatigues, meeting Gerasimov in front of the building serving as a command post before going inside. Ukrainian military, these numbers are staggering, by the way. Ukrainian military lost over 67,000 servicemen and their attempted incursion, said Gerasimov, adding that the Russian troops had reclaimed 1,100 square kilometers, or 86% of the area initially occupied by Kyiv since the start of the counteroffensive last year. The visit comes just hours after media reports about the liberation of Sudzha, the biggest city held in the Kursk region. Some videos appear to show Russian troops raising a flag in the city center. According to some reports, the fighting is ongoing in western and northern outskirts of Sudzha. But the ones I've seen, Russians have re-seized about two-thirds of Sudzha and have basically surrounded the rest. So it's not going to be... It'll be quick work to get that over with. Early this week, Russian military captured, they took back most of Kursk, basically. No need to go through that again. It's interesting to me. This, what do you call them, mercenary, and how we're going to... defeat these mercenaries, how they are talking about these mercenaries. I am in complete disagreement with the way, with this young soldier, 22 years old, foolish for going and fighting on the side of Ukraine. I can only think when I hear about, especially those very young men who know nothing about the history, I shouldn't say stuff like that. Maybe he does. Maybe he was very clear-headed. But it's possible that those 20,000 coming to fight on behalf of Ukraine, including entire units of people coming to fight on behalf of Ukraine, I don't believe they understood what they were getting into or what kind of a fight they were going to engage in. And I don't believe that anybody knew. You can justify actions on both sides either way. It's a military conflict, but this has been a devastatingly horrific conflict very technologically advanced on both sides. This is a war unlike any other. This drone warfare, this missile warfare, this Oreshnik, these Soltsypyok, which are those multiple launch rocket systems that are just incredible. They hold 32, is it 30? Might be 36. I don't remember. Rockets that shoot in rapid succession, take out entire grid squares. You know, people are dying by the thousands over there. This has been an extremely, this has been the most destructive war since World War II. And, you know, this is definitely a bad one. And those, I disagree with keeping this kid in jail. Maybe he's there to serve as a hint to others. I think ultimately he'll be released. If there's ever a ceasefire deal, he'll be part of it. And be, you know, those things are gimmies in a negotiation. You know, you can say, all right, we'll release these prisoners. What, you got to include this prisoner? They're going to. Especially if things go positively, as I believe that they will. I think they'll be pretty positive. And we're going to be looking at this war ending. I don't think it's going to, I mean, my own prediction, I don't think it's going to end that quickly. I think we still got a couple more months, couple, three, before we do. I don't think this ceasefire deal is going to be well received. Personally, I don't think it's going to be well received at all. And I don't think there's any, and certainly not while Ukraine is still occupying Kursk. So I think the Russians are over there saying, well, what are we gonna ask for this ceasefire? What are we gonna get? Because Russia really wants this war over. They don't want a ceasefire. In fact, let me give you the headline, the header of another article that came out. And this is how they think. A ceasefire only benefits those who are retreating. Russia's top foreign relations experts react to the U.S.-Ukraine talks. Politicians, journalists, and analysts react to the news of a proposed 30-day ceasefire. Same thing I said yesterday. So maybe I could fit in as a politician, journalist, or analyst with regard to this. But it's a kind of a lengthy article, but certainly was worth a read. And they talked to four or five people over there, so pretty high level folks. And it's interesting to get other people's points of view. Following high-level talks between U.S. and Ukrainian delegations in Saudi Arabia, two major developments have dominated the media landscape. First, Russia has been proposed to agree to a 30-day ceasefire. Second, Washington is resuming military aid and intelligence support for Kyiv. How Russian politicians, experts, and journalists are responding to this latest turn in negotiations. Fyodor Lukyanov, yes, editor-in-chief of Russia in Global Affairs. Final statement of the delegation shows that in a meeting in Saudi Arabia has gone according to the U.S. plan. White House aimed to pressure Ukraine into acknowledging the need to align with its demand for a cessation of hostilities, a full ceasefire rather than the partial one mentioned by Kyiv. Remember, Kyiv a few days ago said, well, we will do air and sea ceasefires, but on the ground, we're going to keep it up because we want our land back, right? In return, the U.S. said it had to be a complete ceasefire. In return, Washington promised to resume military assistance to Kyiv, which was suspended. agree to a ceasefire, the U.S. said, and you'll get back what you had before. There's some ambiguity regarding the agreement on resources, which may need to be revised and approved. There's no clarity on security guarantees for Ukraine, and I don't think there will be. It seems both issues are still being considered as negotiations continue. The suggestion that Europe should be involved in the peace process indicates that Ukraine won't be left all alone. Overall, Ukraine has swallowed its shame and Zelensky's humiliation and capitulated by expressing the Ukrainian people's strong gratitude to President Trump, the U.S. Congress, and the people of the United States for facilitating meaningful progress toward peace. It didn't express gratitude for U.S. support, but rather for facilitating progress toward peace. As Rubio noted, the ball is now in Russia's court, which aligns with U.S. intentions. Ukraine has complied, and now Russia is expected to enter the game. Interesting. As U.S. National Security Advisor Mike Waltz hinted that there are certain undisclosed agreements, but for now, we can only speculate. If we focused on the public text, like I did yesterday, the proposal in its current form contradicts Moscow's repeatedly stated position that no ceasefire will occur until the parameters of a comprehensive agreement ensuring lasting peace are established. In other words, the fighting will continue till a viable resolution is devised. However, since the U.S. publicly shifted its stance from being a side in the conflict to an assertive mediator, something Trump announced during his memorable meeting with Zelensky, it has become apparent that the dynamics have changed. The Roman numerals seem to have switched places. The 21st century looks more like the 19th century as personal diplomacy between monarchs takes center stage, overshadowing ideological commitment and even military achievement. The outcome will depend on their personal agreement or the lack thereof. In any case, we will soon see the result. As for the royal persons holding these discussions, it is clear whom we are talking about. So according to him, this is a war that's going to be resolved only between Putin and Trump, period. And all the rest is just posturing, which everybody likes to say about Trump anyway. So Trump is posturing, and soon they'll get together and say, here's your Russian words for today. It's called, and I like listening to it because it's по-рюмочке, по-рюмочке. A рюмка is a shot glass. So a рюмка is a little shot glass. And it's customary to по-рюмочке, to have a little shot glass, you pour a drink together, and everybody. Now Trump doesn't drink, from what I understand, and so and I'm not sure Putin drinks all that much, but I know that по-рюмочке is sit at a table, you have a shot, take it back, and see if you can resolve whatever problems you're facing. That was the statement of Mr. Fyodor Lukyanov, editor-in-chief of Russia and Global Affairs. The vice speaker of the Federation Council, Mr. Konstantin Kosachev, the outcome of the U.S.-Ukraine talks in Jeddah reveal a clear truth. Zelensky's attempts to make the tail wag the dog may have worked with Biden, but not with Trump. The terms are set by the Americans, not the Ukrainians. The Ukrainians merely agree with what they are told, bowing and scraping. Look at the absurdity of the following statement. We'll sign the resource agreement when it suits Washington. Zelensky is backed into a corner. As White House press secretary said, Trump put Zelensky in his place. Russian troops are advancing, and so dealings with Russia will be different. Any agreements, and we recognize the need for compromise, will come on our terms, not America's. Remember, I'm reading this from the Russian side. This isn't just bravado. It's acknowledgement that real agreements are still being forged on the front lines, a fact Washington should understand. For now, the main thing is not to let any extraneous comments disturb U.S.-Russia negotiation. Let the negotiators do their job. Victory will be ours. That was by Vice Speaker of the Federation Council, Konstantin Kosachev. Head of Rosatrudnichestvo, which is basically Russian labor, Yevgeny Primakov. What's ours is ours. What's yours, we'll talk about later. That's pretty much Trump's famous art of the deal in a nutshell. So it's hardly surprising the proposed ceasefire in exchange for renewed military aid and intelligence for Ukraine comes off as blatant manipulation. But I believe the game is more complex. First, starting with a door slam approach is simply unprofessional. As they say in Odessa, that's not how business is done. Secondly, let's consider the pause that the Americans have suggested. Nowhere did they explicitly state that they expect an immediate ceasefire from Russia. A special envoy from Trump, Steve Witkoff, is heading to Moscow. The U.S. announced plans for a phone call between Trump and our president, and new negotiations with Russian officials have been announced. What might this indicate amidst the rapidly changing situation on the Kursk front, where our forces are driving out Ukrainian occupiers and liberating one settlement after another? This is from the Russian side, remember. Trump himself has mentioned that the Ukrainian forces are retreating. So it's clear the White House understands what this pause means for the situation on the front. I suspect that the unstated part of this deal involves pushing Ukrainian forces out of Kursk. Thirdly, what is clear and directly follows from President Putin's statement is that we have very specific conditions for any peace agreement. A mere ceasefire won't satisfy Russia. We need a resolution that addresses our interests and acknowledges the fundamental reasons behind the conflict. How many times have we heard that, people? That we have to understand from their point of view why this is happening, and that it's not going to go away if you don't solve those problems. These include Ukraine's neutral status, the rights of ethnic Russians to be Russian, our territories in Donetsk, Lugansk, Kherson, Zaporizhia. Under any circumstances, Ukraine must not pose a threat to Russia. This means we must prevent any risk of revanchism. I sadly don't know that word. That doesn't happen all that often. Which logically entails that Ukraine should not maintain offensive military capabilities or embrace an aggressive Nazi ideology aimed at Russia. Therefore, it will be necessary to dismantle several political and social institutions of the current Ukraine, and the education system must be reformed. How willing is the U.S. to include those issues in the negotiations? In any case, we've already outlined these conditions from our side, and if we're talking about dismantling Ukraine's future military potential and ensuring its neutrality, then both these points completely contradict the idea of sending military supplies or placing NATO peacekeepers there. No doubt, I believe I said most of that yesterday. Here's an old guy, political analyst Sergei Markov. Reasons why Russia might refuse a ceasefire. He just listed them. Number one, a ceasefire would be exploited by the West in Ukraine to halt the advance of the Russian army, strip it of its initiative, supply Ukraine with more weapons, continue extensive mobilization in Ukraine, strengthen the repressive and anti-Russian nature of the Ukrainian political regime. I agree with every single one of those parts of reason number one. Reason number two, the experience of Minsk I and Minsk II agreements clearly demonstrate this pattern. I completely agree with that. Three, the consistent dishonesty of Western politicians and media regarding the conflict, as well as their refusal to acknowledge their own and Ukraine's culpability, strongly suggests that history will repeat itself. How can you not agree with that? Number four, Russian President Putin and other Russian officials have repeatedly stated that what Russia needs is lasting peace, not a temporary ceasefire. That's four. Number five, the West cannot be trusted. Number six, Russia is advancing. A ceasefire only benefits those who are retreating. Wow. That's political analyst Sergei Markov. Wow. Sergei Alexandrovich Markov, if you're interested. A journalist and VGTRK contributor, Andrei Medvedev. Here's a proposed negotiating position, establishing a 30-day ceasefire, but Ukraine must guarantee free exit from the country for all categories of citizens. Well, that's interesting. Another requirement could be the withdrawal of all Ukrainian armed forced units beyond the borders of Kherson and Zaporizhia, along with the transfer of all territories to Russian authorities and the deployment of our military units. Essentially, this would align the situation on the ground with the norms of the Russian constitution. They could pull back in a week, and our troops could move in within another week, followed by 2 weeks of securing and fortifying the borders. While we probably won't see such a scenario unfold, it would be an ideal option because this kind of ceasefire would lead to irrevocable consequences for what remains of Ukraine. I know it's not probable, but nice to dream. This guy I read to you about last week, his name, philosopher Alexander Dugin, and he was on that show Penchenka that well, you can't watch it unless you read subtitles, and I didn't remember seeing any English ones, but they were speaking in Russian there. It was a good show. Trump is eager to end the war in Ukraine because his opponents from the deep state have regrouped and launched a massive counterattack against him and Elon Musk. However, he has no real clear plan on how to achieve this. He is simply not ready to withdraw from the war unilaterally yet. This is precisely the trap laid by the Democrats. Without resolving the Ukraine issue, Trump risks getting increasingly bogged down. That's the swamp for you. A ceasefire is not a serious proposition. That's what I said, especially when Ukraine is clearly losing. But it will take time for everything to fall in place. Let's see who else. One more guy. Valentin Bogdanov, head of the VGTRK Bureau in New York. Now, I don't know what VGTRK is. So perhaps we should find out, don't you think? Why don't we do a quick view and see what the All-Russian State Television and Radio Broadcasting, that's what it is, in New York. Valentin Bogdanov. Interesting. And he says, what does a 30-day ceasefire really mean? This is where things get tricky. Waltz claims that Ukraine is supposedly ready for peace. The problem is that in Kyiv, the word peace often comes with various adjectives, the most popular being just, that twisted into something Orwellian, a peace that quickly turns into war. This was evident the night before the negotiations, as Moscow faced a massive drone attack, which I told you about yesterday, which was followed by the good news of the liberation of Sudia. For the armed forces of Ukraine, taking a 30-day pause to recover from setbacks in Kursk is an ideal strategy, especially considering their experience in undermining numerous other ceasefires since 2014. This is particularly true if America continues to send weapons and provide intelligence support to Ukraine. Does Trump understand this? He probably does. That's why, asserting control at this interim stage, he first states that it takes two to tango, once again excluding Ukraine, then indicates that he will soon call Putin. According to Trump, the Russian leader giving his agreement to the U.S. offer would bring the parties 75% of the way, and dealing with Russia is easier And he did say that, easier than dealing with the Ukrainians. However, success doesn't come from nowhere. An agreement still needs to be reached. Therefore, a subsequent round of negotiations is expected in Moscow, where, according to Axios, Special Envoy Witkoff is about to arrive. Washington has yet to present any concrete proposal. Moreover, discussing proposals with subordinate proxies, an accurate description of the Kiev regime based on Rubio's recent comments on the nature of the Ukraine conflict, is hardly productive. Given that Russia's fundamental conditions are very well known, chiefly lasting peace that considers Russian interests and demands, it's clearly that achieving such peace requires addressing the root causes of the conflict. If Trump manages to resolve these issues within 30 days, that would be fantastic. In 3 days, it would be even better. 3 hours would be spectacular, but there's also a chance he might not succeed at all. In that case, the ball, which Rubio has confidently claimed is now in Russia's court, could easily turn into a weight, dragging him and Trump down. That was the bureau chief for New York for Russian state television, Valentin Bogdanov. Well, I believe that gets us toward the end of where we are, where we were heading today. And we are very much interested in peace. I would love to see something finalized swiftly, if at all possible. However, I'm not very optimistic, to be completely frank with you all. I'm not all that optimistic. None of the discussions that have been ongoing for the last 2 days, since it was made clear the dictates of Rubio and Trump to the Ukrainian heads of state, I don't see that as going far enough to get Russia to take anything serious. However, I was wrong once or twice before, and we shall certainly see what happens. We will see what shall be seen. There's some exciting things coming up. I'm very much interested in listening to the old Ikester, Savodnia, this evening, and listening to his program, finding out what's going on with him. I heard JR say he had a guest, but I don't recall who that is or what they were discussing, but doesn't really matter. Ike's always interesting. I'll be happy to listen to him. Tomorrow we have a really big shoe. We have me, and then we have the Fitzwell Factor. Friday we have Nadine at 9. We have a really big shoe and international flavor and the Eye of the Beholder. And then Monday it starts all over again with the Shield Maidens of Missouri, a really big shoe and international flavor. If you're interested in seeing the schedule, go out to damradio.com/schedule. You can listen to podcasts, listen live on your app on your phone. My show is on internationalflavor.podbean.com. You can listen to those, and they're uploaded there to my own little pretty website if you're interested in watching that. I very much appreciate each of you joining along today. And I encourage you to do so every day. Join me, two dogs, and Vicar when we shall play Pederasto, the game for all the family. Stole that from Monty Python. As many of you know, I'm a Monty Python buff. I do enjoy me some Monty Python. At any rate, that will be the end of today. And I believe we're coming up on some Alan Parsons project, who I particularly like. Have a good day.